Hello, and welcome once again to the Unresolved Podcast, a podcast all about looking at stories that have no ending. I'm your host, Michael Whelan, and this episode is part two of my look at Bardstown, Kentucky. This is an incredibly tragic story following the murder of police officer Jason Ellis just off of Exit 34 on May 25th, 2013. If you recall, on the last episode we left off immediately following Jason's murder, and the investigation had just begun. Headed by the Kentucky State Police Force, the investigation soon hit a brick wall, but that didn't stop weird events from occurring over the next couple of years. Events which have left people questioning everything they once knew about Bardstown. So now, without wasting any more time, here we go, into the odd tale of Bardstown, Kentucky. The investigation into finding Jason's killer, or killers, was looking at any and every possible avenue for a lead. With no eyewitnesses or murder weapon to go off of, the investigation had to lean on a juicy $200,000 reward for information leading to an arrest, most of which was raised in a fundraising format by citizens of Bardstown. It is, by most standards, the largest reward in Kentucky history. Despite having no leads to go off of, the investigators were certain that at least two people had been at the crime scene, based off of information that they still haven't released to the public. There are some indicators to us that would lead us to believe that there was more than one person, said State Police Master Trooper Norman Chaffins. But the real question was asked, who would kill Jason Ellis, who was, by all accounts, a great guy? Investigators looked into his personal life, searching for any straw they could grasp, but they found nothing. No debts, no personal vendettas, nothing. His private life was just as squeaky clean as his public persona. The real fear among Bardstown citizens was that the gunman was walking among them. What scares us, if they will kill a police officer, what's to stop them from killing anybody else? Said Arlene Durbin, the owner of Arlene's Barbershop in downtown Bardstown. To think there's someone walking the streets that cold-blooded and ruthless. So what would inspire someone to commit such a cold-blooded murder, an execution, some call, against this well-adored man? I believe it was a hit, said Bardstown City Council member Tommy Reed. Ellis was putting a dent into somebody's drug trade, and they finally got tired of it and put a hit out on him. I think he was under surveillance, so that they would know his routine. Normally, this would begin to circulate questions about anyone involved in the Bardstown drug trade, and potential ties to Jason Ellis. This leads us to the first lead, the Bardstown Money Gang.
BMG, we on that. Show up where your home at. Bust shots for your dome at. Call crew like where
the Bardstown Money Gang is what it calls itself. A gang. Like most gangs, the self-pronounced BMG pride themselves on their illicit activities and nefarious ties to criminal activities. Jason Ellis, while also being a canine officer, was one of the Bardstown Police Force's most prolific narcotics officers. But while he mostly dealt with small-time drug dealers, Ellis also had some run-ins with the Bardstown Money Gang.
More than a month after police say several men beat up a 62-year-old man in a restaurant parking lot, arrests have been made.
And tonight, Bardstown police tell WLKY's Jessica what likely sparked this fight. She joins us now with the story. Jessica?
Rick, police say the victim used a racial slur to describe these suspects who took serious offense and seriously assaulted that victim. Three young men have since been charged, and tonight one is still on the loose.
It wasn't until last week that authorities were able to arrest a couple of them. Martin Barber was arrested by Lebanon police. Then Officer Jason Ellis got a lucky break when he randomly pulled a car over with the other two suspects inside.
During the initial traffic stop, DeAndre actually bailed out as the car was still moving. I took my chances that Darian was in the car and got lucky, and he was.
The only person of the three suspects on the run right now, DeAndre Douglas, who police described as armed and dangerous. I'm Jessica Oh, WLKY News.
DeAndre Douglas, the leader of the Bardstown Money Gang, was nearly arrested by Ellis, who made the lucky traffic stop and arrested one of the assault suspects, Darian Ellery. DeAndre Douglas and the other suspect would be arrested within weeks by Jason and other Bardstown police officers. But these encounters would be just the tip of the iceberg when it came to the Bardstown police force dealing with the BMG. In August of 2013, just months after the execution of Jason Ellis, an unrelated party was being held in Nelson County. This party, full of young adults and teenagers, was interrupted by a contingency of young males chanting BMG and Big Money Bardstown Gang. These men began to attack the partygoers, including the young women present, punching and kicking whoever they could.
From fun to fear. Keeping her identity hidden, one teen that was at that party Saturday night says a group showed up screaming, "We're the BMG, Bardstown Money Gang." The teen says for more than 30 minutes, several members in the group assaulted multiple people, including herself.
They came in swinging, and they came in aiming to hurt people. Some of them had bandanas around their face, and they were blocking us. We were basically ambushed. The Brant Shekels came up to me and kicked me in the stomach to get me down and started kicking me in the face.
Shekels is the nephew of Bardstown Mayor Bill Shekels. And at that party, the teen says the BMG members were also shouting this.
That they were the cop killers. You know, they're animals. Just a group of delinquent animals that want to terrorize this town.
The Nelson County Police responded to the incident, ultimately arresting two suspects, but believing that there could be many more of the BMG involved. During the arrest, one of the suspects began to taunt the police officers arresting him with claims that the BMG was responsible for the murder of Jason Ellis. According to one of the teenage victims, a participant of the party, she was attacked by one suspect in particular, a young 23-year-old man by the name of Brant Shekels. She claims that Shekels was just one of the multiple attackers, and that she was personally kicked in the stomach and in the head. Also, according to her, during this attack, these members of the BMG were chanting that they were cop killers during their assault upon the innocent partygoers. They came to the party, unprovoked and uninvited, solely to cause ruckus and to harm others. It would be revealed just a short time later that 23-year-old Brant Shekels, the self-proclaimed cop killer, was the nephew of then-Bardstown Mayor Bill Shekels. After the assault on the party in August, Shekels, along with four other members of the Bardstown Money Gang, were arrested. This was Shekels' second arrest in 2 months, and the second time he had claimed credit on behalf of the Bardstown Money Gang for the death of Jason Ellis. Mayor Bill Shekels, the first black mayor of Bardstown, was already dealing with enough criticism before his familial ties to the BMG became public knowledge. But his nephew's criminal endeavors surely emboldened that, and it took Mayor Shekels a few days to come forward and make a public statement. In his statement, Bill Shekels was unapologetic for his nephew's actions, and seemed rather disinterested in protecting him. "You can pick your friends, but unfortunately you can't always pick your relatives," Mayor Shekels said. "Anything that he does, or anybody else named Shekels does, they don't get any special treatment. If they're guilty, they're guilty. If they break the law, they break the law. They suffer the punishment just like anyone else." The Bardstown Money Gang, in addition to this assault on a group of partying teenagers, had also been tied to a series of assaults on elderly Bardstown citizens in the months prior. Bardstown public officials pleaded to the state government to increase the punishment for these type of violent attacks, but they had no luck. Eventually, Shekels and the other members of the Bardstown Money Gang that were arrested, in connection to the August attack, pled guilty and took a plea deal given to them by the Nelson County Circuit Court District Attorneys. Shekels pled guilty to fourth-degree assault, which is only a misdemeanor in the state of Kentucky, and riot in the first degree, which is only a Class D felony. these charges were a lot lighter than many had anticipated, especially since there were multiple eyewitnesses and statements of guilt given by the perpetrators of the attack. Shekels was eventually sentenced to 4 years in prison, which was surprisingly light. He was sentenced to 4 years in prison for trying to incite a riot, and then sentenced separately to 365 days in prison for the assault on the teenage partygoers. Both of the sentences would run concurrently, meaning that Shekels would only need to spend 4 years in prison for assaulting several people at a party and claiming to have killed a local hero. This brings to light just how harshly the Nelson County prosecutors decided to go after Shekels and his BMG comrades. With the public outcry against them, they surely could have thrown the book at the Bardstown Money Gang, but they instead sentenced all of the members to relatively light prison sentences with meager probationary terms to follow. These terms included not being involved with the Bardstown Money Gang or affiliating in any manner, such as in a YouTube music video. So, essentially, all of the BMG members got away with harassing and assaulting dozens of people in their hometown in the months before and after the brutal murder of a hometown hero, and then taking credit for both. One would think that something fishy was afoot, but the story doesn't end there. Not by a long shot. April 21st, 2014. It's been nearly a year since the mysterious death of Officer Jason Ellis. While the tragedy lingers in the back of everyone's mind, where the mystery of the killer still resides, things have begun to return to relative normality. Kathy Netherland was every bit of the American ideal as Jason Ellis was. Approaching 50 years old, Kathy had been working at Bardstown Elementary as a special education teacher for some time now, and she lived with her 16-year-old daughter, Samantha. She had an older daughter, 19-year-old Holly, who had just recently moved out and was away at college. Less than a year beforehand, Kathy's husband, Bob, had died of colon cancer, so it must have been a tough year for her. To lose your loved one to a debilitating sickness, and then have to raise your teenage daughters on your own. I personally can't imagine how strong you must be to do that. And then to work as a special needs teacher during the day? It honestly sounds like an impossible task to me, but it was one that Kathy Netherland was able to manage. Her daughter, Samantha, was a sophomore at the nearby Bardstown High School. According to her sister, Holly, she was the kind of kid that loved to play video games for hours, and could identify each and every Def Leppard song from the opening guitar riff. She loved to sing, and was, by all accounts, a very lively, personable, likable teenage girl. But on the evening of Monday, April 21st, 2014, something dark was afoot. The same type of mystery that took the life of Officer Jason Ellis was unfolding in the Netherland family home, located in Botland, just minutes away from Bardstown itself. And just like the death of Officer Jason Ellis, this story would be every bit as tragic, but perhaps more brutal and terrifying. On April 22nd, 2014, both Kathy and Samantha were noted as being absent from their respective schools. For Samantha, this was odd, but for Kathy to be absent without so much as a phone call, it was shocking. School officials soon got in touch with her family, and Kathy's father, Samantha's grandfather, was sent to check in on them to make sure everything was all right. Unfortunately, everything was not all right. In fact, things were far from it. Kathy's sister, Stacy Hibbard, recalls arriving at the scene to find cop cars all around the Netherland family home, police tape wrapping around the apparent crime scene. Her father, who had been the person sent to check on the Netherland girls, was in absolute distress. "They're gone, and somebody did something terrible to them," he told Stacy on that fateful Tuesday. 19-year-old Holly Netherland, away at college, would receive a phone call from her extended family later that day, a phone call she recalls later on. "On April 22nd, I received a phone call that shattered my life. My mother and my sister were dead," Holly Netherland told reporters. The first thing that ran through my head was, God, you can't take them. You took my daddy. You can't have them too. Both Kathy and Samantha Netherland had been murdered, brutally so. Kathy had been shot multiple times, and she had a cut on her neck. But the worst fate had been saved for 16-year-old Samantha. She was found to have been beaten severely, with serious wounds to her head, and her neck was slashed. Kentucky State Police took the lead on this investigation, just as they had on the Jason Ellis case. The detectives released very few details of the murder to the public, with the death certificates of the victims being released 2 months later, in June. The investigators soon released a clue that they were looking into, a newer model black Chevy Impala that was seen by security cameras leaving the area of the murder, and it had also been spotted by neighbors in the Botland area. "We still believe if we could find that car, we can solve the case," said Kentucky State Police Trooper Jeff Gregory. Just like in the aftermath of Jason Ellis's murder, the area was in a panic. While the death of Jason Ellis was an absolute tragedy, it could have had some kind of rationale behind it. Criminals attacking a cop, drug dealers striking back at the source of their problems, etc. But to attack a middle-aged special education teacher and her teenage daughter, who were already recovering from the death of another loved one, it was absolutely unfathomable. And for it to happen in their own home, with painful methods, was incredibly terrifying.
I want to know why. Why would somebody go and attack my sister? Why would somebody shoot my mother? You walked in their door and wanted something, my mother would have handed it over in a split second.
Kathy had been a beloved special education teacher at Bardstown Elementary School.
She had, like, green shoes and a little green hairband.
It's pretty hard to forget a woman running around the elementary school just as a leprechaun every St. Patrick's Day.
Samantha, a sophomore, was weeks away from her high school prom. The blue balloons are for her, her favorite color, purple for her mother.
I just want it over. I want this whole stuff to end. I want this person brought to justice, and I want some peace.
The family of Kathy and Samantha Netherland quickly put together a $2,500 reward, which in the following months skyrocketed upwards of $50,000. In a further similarity with the investigation to find Officer Jason Ellis's killer, the investigation soon hit another brick wall. Months passed, and now nearly 2 years have passed without so much as a solid lead or a viable suspect. Detectives still believe that the as-yet unidentified Chevy Impala holds the key to finding the Netherlands killer, but they are no closer to finding it now than they were in 2014. You may be thinking to yourself, how could a story get even weirder? Sadly, it continues to do so, marring the small town of Bardstown with further tragedy, heartache, and claims of corruption. Before I continue forward, let me back up just a little bit. In the months following Jason Ellis's murder, one of his senior officers had retired. This isn't unusual on its own, but just months later, in March of 2014, one of their fellow Bardstown officers, Tony Satterley, resigned during an investigation. Led in part by both the Kentucky State Police and the Bardstown Police Department, the investigation had been looking into Satterley for drug charges since February of that year. Satterley would be indicted in March on 10 counts of prescription drug fraud, which alleged that in between the months of January 2013 and January of 2014, he had obtained over 1,825 hydrocodone tablets and 265 tablets of oxycodone. His attorneys would claim that he began to take painkillers after a back injury, and this led to the slippery slope of both legal and illegal prescription drug abuse. According to his admission, he had been helped in this endeavor by a woman named Christy Morris, who worked at his doctor's office. Morris had been writing fraudulent prescriptions for him throughout this entire ordeal, and the story is made even weirder with the knowledge that Christy Morris was dating one of Satterley's colleagues, another Bardstown police officer. So now, less than a year after the murder of Jason Ellis. An officer had retired. One was facing prison charges for prescription drug fraud, and another was possibly involved with the knowledge of the drug fraud, his girlfriend being the one to write bogus prescriptions. And this was happening in a town with just over 20 police officers. Add on top of that, the mayor's ties to the BMG, as well as the Netherland murder, and you have an environment that is soon being built upon distrust and mystery. That environment would continue to fester in the months and years following the murders of Jason Ellis and the Netherland pair. For most, things were returning to normality, but there was an undercurrent of fear and mystery that permeated the air. The question of who had murdered both or either was nowhere close to being answered, and investigators had made that quite clear. On July 3rd, 2015, the tragedy plaguing Bardstown would continue, compounding misery upon itself. Crystal Rogers was a 35-year-old mother of five who was in what seemed to be a healthy relationship with her boyfriend Brooks Houck. The two had a child together, an infant son named Eli. Crystal would last be seen on July 3rd after texting a friend that her and Brooks had gotten a babysitter and they were excited to have a kid-free night. The two of them went to the Houck family farm, likely in an attempt to have a night away from it all. But unfortunately, Crystal would never be seen by another soul again. Two days after she had last been seen by anyone, Crystal's car, a maroon Chevy Impala, was found abandoned along the Bluegrass Parkway. Inside, the keys remained in the ignition, and her belongings were scattered throughout, such as her cell phone, purse, makeup, and other personal objects. The car had one flat tire, but otherwise looked to be in good working condition, and had no sign of Crystal herself. On the same day that her car was found, she was officially declared missing, and the investigation to find her began. Like most investigations, it started by checking in on those close to her, and those that saw her last. In this case, it starts with her boyfriend, Brooks Houck. Houck claims that he and Crystal went to the family farm that night, stopping by to feed the livestock along with their infant son, Eli, and then they went home. He alleges that when he woke up in the morning, on the 4th of July, Crystal was gone. Brooks claimed that she would do this from time to time, going to quote-unquote fantasy parties or other social outings with her friends. In the middle of the night. By herself. What's even more disconcerting is that during a police interview on July 8th, Brooks was interrupted by a phone call from his brother, Nick Houck. The content of this phone call can only be guessed at, but this information will become very relevant in just a moment. It is also worth noting that Nick Houck, this brother of the missing woman's boyfriend, was a Bardstown police officer. The very next day, on July 9th, 2015, Brooks appeared on Nancy Grace in an effort to defend himself. For as many faults as I have with Nancy Grace, and trust me, I have several, she did a pretty great job in the interview of ridiculing Brooks and his logic.
Joining me right now, in addition to her parents, Tom and Sherry Ballard, her boyfriend that she lived with, they're in their three-bedroom suburban home. Brooks Houck is with us. So, Brooks, you go to bed, and she's still playing games on her phone. The next morning, around 8 o'clock, you notice that she's missing. Did you report her missing?
No, ma'am.
Why?
That is a great question, and one that I definitely want to hit the public and the media. I was not in the least little bit alarmed in any way, shape, or form. We have had a stress relationship at times, and one of the ways that Crystal has always chose to cope or to deal with that is by going to a young woman's name, Sabrina, That is her cousin, her dad's brother's daughter, whom she's very close to. And she spent the night there on several occasions.
When you say several, do you mean one, three, 20?
In the neighborhood of 4 to 6.
Okay,
like that.
Tom and Sherry Ballard, were you aware of that? Do you know who Sabrina is?
Yes, ma'am.
That's my niece.
Okay. Did you know that she goes and spends the night over there when she's having an issue at home?
I've known probably one time.
Right. Okay, I want to go back to Brooks Houck, who was the last person to see her alive. Brooks, did you go on to the July the 4th get-together that day?
Yes, I did.
Even though you didn't know where she was?
Well, I was expecting, I'd put in a phone call that morning and then around lunch. And usually the maximum period of time that she has stayed gone has only been like a day to a day and a half at the most. And as a result of that, I thought that she would.
Did you try to call her?
Us. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you, ma'am.
Did you try to call her during that time?
Not while I was there, there at the fourth. I called her prior to leaving to head in that direction. Yes, ma'am.
Some people have accused you of not being involved enough in the search efforts. What's your response?
That is a great question, and one I certainly appreciate you asking me. And that is all of my efforts in searching for her have been done behind the scenes with the Nelson County Sheriff's Office.
Like what?
Detective Snow, who's leading the investigation, and Jason Allison, who's a deputy there assisting him, along with the Kentucky State Police Agency, post number 12.
So well, my question was what you had been doing with them, but let me ask you this. I know that you agreed to take a polygraph. Did you pass?
They, because of the way that the lines or whatever were on the thing, they determined it to be what's called inconclusive. I'm not exactly sure what that means, but they did tell me it does mean that I wasn't lying or I didn't pass it or I didn't fail it. They just ruled it inconclusive, and that's exactly the way that it stands. I've been 100% completely honest with everyone. I've been 100% cooperative, and everything that has been asked of me, I've not asked for any kind of legal advice or assistance or an attorney of any nature. I'm 100% completely innocent in this, and I have exhausted my efforts with the law enforcement agencies to gather all the facts necessary to allow me to have a clean name again. And that's very important to me. I have not responded to a lot of the negativity and all this animosity because I want the emphasis to remain on Crystal's safe return home, and that's where I want it to. I want it to stay focused in that area rather than dealing with any of the animosity.
Police began to focus their investigation in on Brooks, believing him to be the main suspect. They would eventually find out that the family farm he visited with Crystal on the night of her disappearance had a security camera, and they were able to access that footage. That footage showed both Crystal and Brooks arriving at the farm, but only Brooks leaving later, shortly before midnight, which is far later than he claimed that he stayed there originally. The day that Brooks had the interview with police, in which his brother called to possibly warn him that he was a suspect, the two brothers would make a trip out to the family farm. They would be there for nearly 2 hours, doing something that neither brother can remember. That's not a joke on my part. When Nick Houck would be interviewed by police investigators, just days after this brotherly meetup, he claimed ignorance. He couldn't remember why he or his brother had been out at the family farm, or what they had been up to that had taken nearly 2 hours out of their day. I don't know about you, but just follow me here. If my brother had a girlfriend go missing, and he was being investigated for her disappearance, and he then called me up on the same day that he was being investigated by police officers. Don't you think you might remember what happened when you met him at the family farm, which was the last place she had been seen missing? Maybe that's just crazy, but I feel like that's something you would remember just a few days later. But apparently this was too much to ask out of Nick Houck, a Bardstown police officer that had spent years upholding peace and justice in this area of rural Kentucky. This wasn't the end of the story. Nick would go on to be suspended in September by Bardstown Police Chief Rick McCubbin, as the investigation began to focus on him and his ties to Crystal Rogers' disappearance. He would go on to fail a polygraph administered by the investigators, just like his brother had, and he would later be fired by the Bardstown Police Department on October 16, 2015. He was fired on the grounds of interfering with a police investigation. This, coincidentally, was the same day that Brooks Houck was officially named a suspect in the disappearance of Crystal Rogers. A Nelson County sheriff would later tell the media that Crystal Rogers is presumed dead. There is an hour and a half long interview with Brooks Houck, administered by the Kentucky State Police, available to watch on YouTube. This is the July 15th interview, in which the KSP alleged that Nick Houck was helping his brother Brooks out in more than just one way. They reveal that blood spatter was found in the trunk of Nick Houck's police cruiser, and that a blanket found in the trunk, quote-unquote, lit up like Chernobyl to their black lights. The investigators have a good idea of what happened, that Brooks Houck killed Crystal Rogers, did a decent job of trying to cover up the crime, and had his brother, a police officer at the very department investigating her disappearance, help him out. The blanket in his trunk, which he had no explanation for, was covered in human DNA that also matched up with other DNA found in spots within his trunk. Furthermore, neighbors of Nick Houck alleged that they spotted him moving something from the trunk of his police cruiser to somewhere inside his own mother's car. But we all know how reliable eyewitness testimony can be at times. Regardless of the investigation into finding Crystal Rogers, or who was responsible for her disappearance, one is able to easily see that something is flawed within Bardstown, Kentucky. A place that embodies the beauty of small-town living, in rural America, has become rife with so many claims of corruption or police involvement that the town itself has started to become agitated. In December of 2015, just years after the multiple crimes and scandals began to rock the town, an arrest was finally made. Danny Singleton, a longtime employee of Brooks Houck, was arrested on 38 counts of perjury for lying under oath to investigators. This was the first arrest made in connection to the Crystal Rogers disappearance, as Brooks Houck had been named a suspect, but he's still yet to receive any charges. The day after Danny Singleton's arrest, a rally was held outside of the Nelson County Justice Center. Organized and held in parts by friends and family of Crystal Rogers, the rally was aimed at keeping the name Crystal Rogers relevant in the news media, to raise awareness for her disappearance and the other unsolved crimes in Bardstown. While most members of the rally promoted a positive message, a few were quick to blame the police force and local officials for not doing enough. The rumors of corruption and police involvement, mixed with the scandals rocking the police department itself, were reaching a boiling point. Police Chief Rick McCubbin was quick to come out with a statement on his own Facebook page, penning an open letter that declared the accusations of police corruption baseless. He urged the community of Bardstown to come together and help solve these crimes, a mentality that should be shared to help these unresolved stories find some kind of solution. While an answer to the disappearance of Crystal Rogers seems to be on the horizon, there is no end in sight for the families of Officer Jason Ellis or Kathy and Samantha Netherland. There have still been no arrests made in connection to either crime, and as far as we know, the police don't even have any leads when it comes to identifying a suspect. Relatives of both families, as well as those of Crystal Rogers, maintain an open line of communication that they hope one day leads to any of their stories getting resolved. Whether or not the three crimes are related in any way, and regardless of if the claims of police corruption have any merit or not, it's evident that there is something mysterious happening in Bardstown, Kentucky. Well, there you have it. Another episode of the Unresolved Podcast. And this one took a bit longer than I'd hoped for. I do apologize for that. I hope to have the next one out a bit quicker, although hopefully I'll be able to establish a firm schedule moving forward. As I've stated at the end of the last two episodes, life has just been rather chaotic as of late. Just like last episode, I owe a huge debt of gratitude to Tyson Nordgren, who has really helped me out when it comes to the production of this episode and the last episode. He's helped out a ton in that regard, and has even created most of the music you've heard throughout. I can't thank him enough, and I hope he'll be around for many more episodes to come to help me out. If you'd like to keep in touch with me or the podcast, you could do so in a variety of methods. You can find the podcast on Facebook at facebook.com/theunresolvedpodcast. The podcast is also on Twitter and can be found at unresolvedp. Fair warning, I don't use Twitter that often, so updates there are very sporadic, but I try my best. I'm a bit of a wordy fellow, so 140 characters just isn't enough for me. If you want to utilize email, you can fire off one of those at theunresolvedpodcast@gmail.com. Or you could even call in or text at 831-200-3550. Also known famously around these parts as 831-200-ELK-0. The podcast website is still a work in progress, but it contains a transcript of each episode, along to links from music utilized throughout, sources used, and videos or audio clips placed throughout. It's a good place to start if you want to dig deeper into each story, as I try to do a decent job of covering all the bases, but I occasionally miss something or misspeak and leave some details out. I don't do it intentionally, I promise. I apologize to anyone who thinks that the end segments can be a bit wordy at times. I just can't help myself. For the next episode, I plan on hitting up Australia as a setting once again, in a story that just morbidly celebrated its 50th anniversary. I'm sure many of you are aware of the story that I'm speaking of, as it's a rather famous one, but it's a very interesting story nonetheless, and I can't wait to get into it. But until next time, stay safe, and I'll be speaking with you all soon.